And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Raptors Reasonless Podcast. I'm your host, Blake Murphy. Joining me on the line, as always, fresh from a walk with Walter in the snow, Eric, what's up, man?
Not too much. Just enjoying this weird purgatory week between Christmas and New Year's. How are you?
Not great. I'm in quarantine here, having got back from Tampa. And, quarantine in general is something we've all got used to. But doing that over Christmas and New Year's while, things on the work side have gone as they have gone. The start of the Raptors season being delayed and they still haven't played any games.
Yeah, no, it's been unfortunate.
Yeah, the 0-0 Toronto Raptors.
Yeah, or just, as Alex Wong put it, the 2-3 Toronto Raptors.
Yes, gotta count those Schadenfreude victories.
It's not going great. We haven't been here in a while, which is to say we haven't been here in this specific place since 2005, 2006.
We haven't been here in this specific place my entire time covering the team, even if you include like blogging years. So
even that's true for me. I was 2005, 2006. I started covering the team a bit in 06, 07, and then full time in 07, 08. So that predates me. That dates back to the Mike James year. And Mike James called my brother, who was covering the team for the Toronto Sun, Quag, because he sort of he thought he looked like Quagmire from Family Guy. So that's where we're at.
Family Guy
references were cool.
Unless your brother looked dramatically different 15 years ago, I'm having trouble seeing it.
I think he just, like, the head shape is sort of similar, and I think that's maybe where it ends. He certainly doesn't have the outgoing personality of him.
that's for sure. All right, Eric, before we get into things, a little trivia for you about that 2005-2006 season. So that is the last time the Raptors started 0-3. They actually started that season 0-9. To try to get things going over that 9-game losing streak, they tried 4 different starting centers. Eric, can you name them?
No. Jelani McCoy?
No.
No? Oh, my God. Okay.
What a disaster of a start.
Hoffa?
Yeah, Hoffa's one.
We're not counting Bosch. He was the nominal power forward.
I mean, there was one setup where you could have called him the center alongside a stretch big, but...
Oh, God.
Splitting hairs there.
What centers would have been on the team then?
Splitting red hairs there.
Bonner?
Yeah, Bonner's another one.
Thank you.
As another hint, this was the post-Vince trade year.
Oh, no. Aaron Williams?
Yeah, Aaron Williams is another one. You got one more.
Okay.
More and then you're out of the woods here.
Very good. You were very kind to me. Lauren Woods.
Yeah.
In my defense, Lauren Woods and Jelani McCoy are the same person.
Sure. We could throw Jerome Moiso in there, too, if you want.
No,
he
had
her off the top of the backboard.
She had a very specific place in Raptors history. I don't think that either Lauren Woods or Jelani McCoy has that place. Jerome Moiso was at the heart of the 0-0-0 Sam Mitchell rant.
Yes, that's something that I mean, look, we spent a good part of the NBA's hiatus doing historical Raptors lookbacks, and it really threw into perspective how fortunate we've been to cover the team during this era. Oh boy, do do we have to hope that the 0-3 start does not take us down that path? Before we get into that 0-3 start, as a reminder, you can go to theathletic.com/we the six. That's the number six. And you can get a buy one, get one off subscription. So buy one, gift one, basically, between now and January 3rd. Also, if you click either mine or Eric's articles right now, I believe there's a flash sale until the end of the calendar year here in Canada for $1 a month. So I think that's a slightly better deal. But if you miss that, there's still the buy one, gift one until January 3rd.
BOGO.
We do passable work and you should go check it out. Eric, the Raptors did start the season 0-3. They blew a lead against New Orleans in their home opener in Tampa, and then they blew a lead on the road against San Antonio, and then they blew a lead in Philadelphia last night. We'll get into some of the specifics of how they've lost these three games and what we can extrapolate from them, but people seem to be, if not panicking, at least pretty frustrated. I'm wondering what your overall level of concern is after three games here.
Certainly, if not confirms, gives a lot of, you know, supporting evidence to theory that the Raptors just don't have that high ceiling that the other quote-unquote contenders in the Eastern Conference do. We've seen the offense struggle for large portions of each game. There's been sort of a scoring drought that they've been unable to stop for too long. In each game came at, when did it come? And was it, I guess, in the third quarter against the Sixers, but there's been one each game. And that's how you end up with two times in three games scoring fewer than 100 points in the Philly game, at least until Joel Embiid started getting fouled every possession, was at a really quick pace, and then it slowed down. But, you know, and obviously in the modern NBA, if you're scoring below 100 points, something's not going right. So it's also confirming what we think about the offense, or what we maybe feared about the offense, with all the caveats that training camp was short, three preseason games, we're still in... You know, we're at the point where the season might actually be starting now in a normal season. So
someone should tell the Raptors.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It hasn't been a lack of effort. They just aren't crisp. And they lack that. I mean, as great as Kyle Lowry's been, this is something we discussed during the Boston series. He's not able to just get a shot off and get like a great shot off anytime he wants. He's not that type of superstar.
And so you maybe shouldn't be relying on your 34, almost 35-year-old point guard to be the only guy who can create a shot.
Yeah, read my game story at theathletic.com after you've subscribed. The defense was obviously not good, although I think there was some shooting randomness involved in the first two games. I thought the game against Philadelphia was a much more recognizable effort on that end, you know, certainly well beyond good enough to win that game. So overall, they're struggling in the ways that we thought they might. Their top end talent is not as high as some other teams. And it's worrying if you're expecting this team to make any sort of run. I mean, I don't think like, do I think they can miss the playoffs? Sure, I'd still predict them to make the playoffs, but you know, that it's definitely, like I said, it's confirmed some fears about the weaknesses of this team and how important they actually are.
For sure, and I think it's tough because obviously sequencing plays such a big role in how we evaluate these things, where these three games as like isolated incidents are not dramatically, you know, like they weren't good games, none of them, but they're all like, okay, well, the half court offense struggled or the defense wasn't there this game or shooting variance that game. But when you stack three on top of each other, it feels quite alarming. And I think the other reason this feels more dramatic than a three game losing streak would otherwise feel is that it's we've all become pretty accustomed to the Raptors being the team on the opposite end of games like this. For years, they've been the league leader or close to the league lead in double-digit comebacks season after season. It's usually them who are being this plucky, annoying team who you can't put down. And now, per ESPN Stats and Info, they're the first team in 20 years to blow three straight double-digit leads to start a season. It's just, it's the complete inverse of what made the Raptors so compelling and what established such a high floor for them the last couple years is that I'm paraphrasing someone else on Twitter, and I can't remember who it was, but basically the Raptors have spent the last 7 or 8 years always finding ways to win, and now they're finding ways to lose. And it's so apologies to whoever tweeted that, and I can't remember, but that's a it's a good way to put it, I think, just in terms of, you know, what people have come to expect and where people's baseline is entering a season. And now to see the complete mirror image of that is alarming.
I mean, it's not like I think a good indication of that was just sort of seeing Sixers Twitter on Tuesday night. Seeing like
love Sixers Twitter.
Like we always lose that game to the Raptors. Like that game is, I think our friend Andrew Unterberger tweeted it. It's like that game has happened 12 times over the last 3 years against the Raptors, and I'm pretty sure the Raptors have won it 11 times. And you know, obviously the numbers are a bit ratcheted up there, but that's the way it feels. And you know, the double digits thing doesn't bother me as much. It's not like they blew a 20-point lead at any point.
They did blow two 14-point leads last night.
Yeah, which isn't good. So that is obviously equal to one 28-point lead.
Yes.
It's obviously easier in today's game to make up these leads with more three-pointers, but it's not like the Sixers were hitting a barrage of shots. If anything, their slow start was attributed to them missing some pretty clean looks. I don't think, again, it just says a lot, mostly about the Raptors' offense. I think, you know, we said so much about the defense over the first two games, and deservedly so, but the problem is still the problem here, and there's no on-roster solution for now. Whether the coaching staff and some improved play can cobble one or two together, we'll see. But there's no, like, obvious solution, I don't think.
Yeah, they're sure. Well, I mean, I think they're... The thing is, there's no obvious, you know, catch-all solution that will fix everything.
Yeah.
I do think there are a lot of little things they could be doing better.
Of course.
And that's always the case because, like, when you are the worst offense in basketball by 2.7 points per 100 possessions, there's obviously a lot that you can be doing a little better. The Raptors, 11.2 points per 100 possessions below the league average right now in scoring, which is, you know, I know people have some concern about the defensive rebounding for sure, and the transition defense hasn't been all that good, but the Raptors are quietly still like ninth in defensive rating so far, despite not really looking like themselves, other than the first half, I would say, against Philadelphia. They haven't looked that sharp at that end. So the defense, you know, that defensive floor is establishing already, despite the talking points around that. Most of my concern, and I mentioned this on Sportsnet 590 the other day when I got asked about any concerns about the defense. I just, no matter what's going on, when you start Kyle Lowry, Fred VanVleet, OG Anunoby, and Pascal Siakam, I'm just going to give you the benefit of the doubt that you will become a good defense at some point when the sample expands. Most of the concerns here are on the offensive end. Like I said, the Raptors are dead last in offensive rating. They're 25th in effective field goal percentage. They're 23rd in turnover rate. They are 22nd in offensive rebounding rate. And they're dead last in free throw rate. Not surprisingly with some of this stuff, Eric, what do high variance shots tend to do?
They vary highly.
And the Raptors are shooting more three-point shots than any team in the league. 44.4% of their field goal attempts have come from beyond the arc. That's excluding garbage time and comes per cleaning the glass. The Raptors haven't shot terribly on threes. They're at a league average 36.2%. But when you take that many threes, you're going to have some cold streaks, as we saw in the third quarter against New Orleans, and you're going to have some hot streaks. And more importantly, I think that this is painting with a very broad brush, and it's not going to hold in every case, but your 3-point shooting at that level of volume is going to be more of a ceiling raiser, I guess, or ceiling establisher. Whereas, you know, the common talking points about how the more reliable way to create offense is at the rim and at the free throw line, you know, I do think that there's something to that. And the Raptors simply are not getting to the rim or to the free throw line. You know, I think part of this, I know people have been frustrated by the Raptors being dead last in free throw attempts. And I get it. There are occasional times where Fred VanVleet gets put on his ass, or that Pascal Siakam block charge in a clutch situation. I get that there are isolated incidents, but you also look and the Raptors are taking the fourth lowest amount of shots at the rim in the league, and they are taking the most threes. I think that just, you know, that's a very, very passive shot profile. Like, I can't imagine there's another team that's in the so-called, I guess, danger zones or the ranges that you get fouled in more less often than the Raptors right now. And that's, you know, because they're shooting so many threes, they're still only a little below average in terms of like expected effective field goal percentage, because threes are good in general. But when you are only getting to the line at a bottom five rate, and they're at a bottom 10 rate in that kind of short mid-range area too, you know, it's hard to get easy. They're not getting any of the easy points, I guess, is what I'm saying. And not that going to the rim and getting hacked is an easy thing to do by any means, but getting to the free throw line is, you know, layups and free throws are the most efficient shots on the floor, as much as we talk about analytics affecting three-point volume or whatever. Layups and free throws are still what you want to get the most. And the fact that the Raptors are getting almost none of those, they're also finishing at the rim at a bottom five rate as well. You know, this is just a very passive offensive attack so far. And they're, even if you break it down by play type, you know, they're not attacking very much on the drive to shoot at all. Most of their drives are with the intention to pass, which was true last year too. Eric, I guess this is, again, a broad question, but do you think this team has it within them to be a more aggressive offensive attack, like tactically and strategically? Or is this going to be, you know, someone has to finish last in free throw rate every year, and a team that shoots a ton of threes and doesn't get to the rim is probably going to be high among the suspects?
Yeah, I mean, as Doc Rivers was asked at the beginning of his availability before the game on Tuesday night, what he thinks about having Joel Embiid and what it's been like to have that sort of dominant post center. And he basically said, it's great to have a run stopper. And you could see why last night. Like, he was just getting fouled, and it wasn't always like with the ball or in like scoring positions. It's just, you know, his presence creates that sort of contact, and he had 11, I think he had 11 free throws in the first half, and the Raptors had 4. And, you know, it was sort of one of those nights where I thought Nick Nurse might come in and like rail against the refs. He was certainly doing so during the game. And by the way, to Nick and all NBA coaches, like, keep your masks on.
Yeah, seriously. Please.
Like,
Doc Rivers wore his as a chin strap last night. It looked like every guy in my high school trying to grow facial hair.
Yeah, that's not how masks work. And yeah, like, I've just seen Nick do it specifically, but like all of them seem to be. I'm not sure Pop did it, but anyway, just keep your mask.
Who could focus on Pop's mask when he's got that beautiful flow coming out of the back of it?
It's got the core hair. You gotta love it. I look, Fred VanVleet is always going to be attacking to pass. Like, he's just not good enough. I mean, not on every time he goes in, but on the whole, he does that more because he's just not a dynamic enough finisher right now. And you'd like him to develop those skills, but it certainly doesn't look like that's come along for his game yet. And that's worrying, especially when paired with Pascal Siakam, who's really who you have to worry about the most at this stage. And, you know, it's his play has been going on too long, you know, when you include the bubble and the pre-bubble when he was slumping a bit, and now into this regular season, to just write it off with any one thing. Like, there are some, you know, serious concerns here. Like, I think I'm comfortable saying he's better than this, but, you know, but yeah, I'm not.
I would hope so. He's currently in the 0th percentile for points per shot attempt. So let's hope he has a higher floor than that.
Yeah, but, you know, his areas for growth are being exposed. And, you know, Nick Nurse's first answer after the game, when asked about their lack of free throws or sort of their lack of aggression, and I didn't really see it as a lack of aggression necessarily, which is why the word passiveness is throwing me off a bit. Like, you could see instances in which they were trying to get there and just, you know, failing once they did, or failing to get there in the first place.
Sure, like, but Philly's big, and I understand but it's like, and even New Orleans is a little big.
Yeah,
but ultimately, the fact that they couldn't do it against San Antonio with DeMar at the four.
Yeah, no, like, that's problematic, obviously.
I love Jakob Poeltl, but he's not a guy that should tilt your offensive strategy.
But as Nick Nurse was saying, like, he listed off a bunch of things, like you come to a pass and you just don't catch it, like, or you go to the rim and...
That swing to the corner three where it just went through his fingertips.
Yeah, and he had, like, I think he was thinking about the drive, right? Like, I think, I mean, it wasn't as much when I watched the replay that, like, he had already started his drive, but I think he wanted to go and he knew how much was left in the shot clock. It was about 5 or 6 left on the clock. And he just didn't do the first thing first. And, like, he lost the ball out of bounds when they were down 1 point or 2 points, maybe, on the play that was reviewed. And that's just, like, I don't even think it's a weak take, but you're not able to absorb any sort of contact and put together, like, a decent shot on the rim. And they need him to be that guy. Like, for so long, dating back to the DeMar era, like, that's what kept the Raptors offensively relevant, is him specifically could get to the line throughout the game and even into the fourth quarter. And Pascal has yet to show that ability to set an offensive floor. And, you know, obviously, as they rank the worst team, they need the floor to be higher than this if they want to make the playoffs at the very least. So I think Lowry and Siakam can be more effective getting into the pack. I mean, Lowry's been pretty good, but I think they both, as far as the big playmakers are concerned, have that ability to give the Raptors a bit more consistency in the paint or getting to the paint. I don't think that's where Fred VanVleet's game is right now, and I think that at some point you have to look at that as a, you know, the way you're building the team going forward.
Yeah, I mean, Fred's a very good shooting guard, is how maybe you describe where his lead ball handler game is at right now.
Yeah.
Just to finish up on Siakam, he is only taking 20% of his attempts at the rim, which is half as much as last year, which was already a big drop off from his more successful years. Obviously more difficult when teams are gearing up for you. And it should be noticed, Siakam has been a improved playmaker so far this year, easily the highest assist percentage of his career so far, even controlling for usage. But yeah, the scoring's got to improve. And that includes getting some easier looks and some freebies at the rim. I have thought process-wise, you know, in first and third quarters, when maybe there's more of a script coming out of the gate, things have looked a little better process-wise. Using Siakam at the elbow more in horn sets, a little pistol action and semi-transition. The kind of stuff that can get either him easy buckets or the guys orbiting around him easy buckets. But that has not sustained in any way.
We've certainly seen some more 1-4 pick and roll, too, I would say.
I
remember, I think it was against Philly that Fred screened for him. I don't think it resulted in much, but that was something both of us were calling for more against Boston, and we've seen a bit more of that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's where the Raptors can look and be encouraged by some of the, I mean, dynamism is a step too far, but like OG Anunoby has looked really good on the roll and passing out of the short roll and as a screener. And Alex Len made that great pass out of on the roll last night to a corner shooter. And Chris Boucher, obviously, he didn't play much against Philadelphia, but he's been a pretty good rim runner for them off the bench. So there are the makings there of interesting pick and roll combinations, and the fact that you can kind of put a couple of your forwards in handling situations, or basically the fact that you can use Siakam, Lowry, and Van Vliet on either end of the pick and roll makes you, you know, theoretically more dynamic. We just need to see a little bit more of it. And I guess if there's a positive to take away from these three games, obviously, you know, Bane's fan club joked that the better approach, the better perspective than the Raptors blew three double-digit leads is that they've gotten a double-digit lead in three straight games. You know, over those three games, the minutes with the key pieces have trended upward. And that's mostly Lowry-driven when you do the on-off analysis. The Raptors are so dramatically better with Lowry on the floor than off right now. It's almost overwhelming. But the starting lineup has been, you know, close to neutral. They're minus 2.8 net rating, but in that small sample, that's, you know, that's not statistically significant from neutral, really, nor would plus 2.8 be. So I think they're starting to figure it out, and Bane, you know, that lineup's been pretty good defensively. And as Baines continues to figure it out, maybe that can further establish. And then I think, you know, Len didn't blow anyone away against Philadelphia, and Boucher's been really good in the first two games and then only played 4 minutes last night. I think they've gotten what they could have kind of hoped for from the backup center position. The big question for me now is obviously, you know, Siakam and Van Vliet just have to be better. That's the long and short of it at their pay scale and their importance to this team. But those non-Lowry minutes that they've lost so dramatically, and give me 1 second, I have the stat here on exactly what it is. So the Raptors have played to a plus 14 with Lowry on the floor, and they are minus 40 in 33 minutes without him, which is crazy. They almost literally have not got to the line when Lowry's not on the floor. Eric, part of this is, you know, Van Vliet and Siakam struggling, especially because the staggering has tended to be Lowry and Ananobi together and Van Vliet and Siakam together, which Nurse settled on late last year and we expect it coming into this year, and I think is still, you know, probably the right combination of starters. But they haven't gotten much from the bench outside of the center position. Norman Powell has really struggled in his 20 minutes per game from a decision-making standpoint, from a finishing standpoint, from a defensive standpoint especially. You know, Matt Thomas has shown flashes, but Nick Nurse doesn't sound very happy with how they've managed around his defense. Stanley Johnson got a big opportunity last night, and while I thought he played well by the standards of Stanley Johnson and his Raptors tenure so far, the Raptors were a big negative in his minutes, and I think he probably played too much relative to what even a good Stanley Johnson game looks like. And we haven't seen Malachi Flynn. We haven't really seen Terrence Davis. We haven't seen much of DeAndre Bembry. You know, where are you at with these non-Lowry lineups? Because it has to, I don't know, maybe Lowry's joke from the preseason about Nick saying he's going to keep his minutes down and then play him 42 minutes a night is accurate, and that's the way the Raptors fix this, is just running Kyle Lowry into the ground. But I don't think that's a sustainable solution. So what are we looking at to fix these non-Lowry minutes?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is having, at least from how they see it, and to an extent I see it, is they need Norm to come around more than he has. And while I'm not as, you know, I think maybe last season was a bit of a outlier for Norm. I'm not sure he's that good offensively.
He's not.
I think he's better than this. And so
he would almost have to be, right?
Well, this is a running theme now of this podcast. And I think he will be able to be like a very important piece in a lot of lineups. We've seen it before. We'll see it again. And I think that's sort of Nick Nurse's approach. As for the rest of it, I mean, I do like that he experimented based on matchup. I think that was the right thing to do.
Yeah, I don't really have an issue with Stanley Johnson getting a look as much as I do with him getting 22 minutes.
Well, he was doing the things, you know, like,
I mean, he was doing the things, and I tweeted as much that, like, I thought he played well relative to what our normal expectation for Stanley Johnson is. But he also just, like, you know, I thought he defended well and
yeah, he's not giving you offensive pop, like, in terms of play creation. But I mean,
he defended Simmons and Harris well enough.
That's not what they were looking for in that situation. Should they be looking for it more often? Should this team be willing to sacrifice more on defense if it gets them offensive creation? You know, probably. That's what their profile sort of says, is like, you gotta, if you have to raise a floor, you've gotta sacrifice something in a lot of cases, and maybe that's how good you can be defensively. I mean, the interesting one, for all sorts of reasons, and something I'm not entirely comfortable speaking about, is Terrence Davis, because he played well enough last year that he should be getting opportunities, but there's obviously his legal matter hanging over things.
I don't even know. Like, I don't think there's a moral difference between playing 5 minutes over or playing 3 minutes over the first three games and playing 12 minutes over the first three games. Like, to me, the line of moral imperative or what, you know, if you feel uncomfortable with Davis being on the roster, I don't see that there's a difference between him playing minutes and him.
Yeah.
Not playing.
And I generally agree with you, but do they? Like, that, I guess that's what I'm wondering, because
I would ask, why did he play so much in the preseason?
And if they don't feel that way, then why isn't he playing? Because, again, his track record shows he's an NBA player. Like, he's an NBA rotation player over the course of a regular season. This is why I don't want to have this conversation, is because, like, I don't, like... You know, I think in a perfect...
We don't know the answer.
Yeah. Like, I don't know the answer. I'm uncomfortable with all of it. If he's at all, you know, guilty of what he has been accused of, I don't think he should be on the roster, on this roster at least. I don't want to take away his, you know, right for a living if they come to a court agreement, but it doesn't need to be with the Raptors. But we don't know the answer. But all things being equal, which again, they're not, it's weird that he's not playing, because he does give you some of that, you know, if not primary creation, and he can do a little bit of that, but certainly when the ball's swung to him, he can either shoot or drive and make quick decisions.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Yeah, so, you know, this is kind of the issue with, you know, being a quote-unquote depth team that doesn't know who their, you know, 7, 8, 9 guys are, is that every night you can make a case for a different guy, right? Like, Alex Len against Embiid and Dwight Howard made sense. You know, I could see where you were coming from with Stanley, even though, again, I wouldn't have played him half the game, probably. And then, you know, some nights it might look like it's Terrence Davis or Matt Thomas, or, you know, if you want that kind of offensive pressure, give Paul Watson a shot. You can go through the whole roster and come up with an explanation why each guy should be the guy getting that shot, but you can only give one or two of them a shot at a time. The one that I'm most surprised that has not gotten a shot, and I understand why when it comes to rookies and getting up to speed in the NBA and how short the offseason was, I thought Malachi Flynn looked really good in the preseason. And I think, you know, when they drafted him, I was pretty modest in my expectations for what he'd look like this year. I think I penciled him in for like 10 minutes a game when I did my rotation, my theoretical rotation breakdown. And I saw him, you know, in that setup, I had him playing alongside Lowry in a lot of transition units, because I think that that's a nice way for a point guard to learn. 3 games in, including the preseason, I think I would maybe flip that and have him help those Van Vliet Siakam units with an extra ball handler, and someone who, you know, rookie caveats aside, like, is one of their probably most polished pick and roll operators already. Now, I'm not saying Flynn would solve everything. He does have a net rating of 100 in 1 minute and change on the season. No NBA team has ever scored when Malachi Flynn is on the floor. But in seriousness, I do think, you know, it's part of why we like the pick, was that you look at what the Raptors' weaknesses were last year and where they projected to have weaknesses in their transitional units, and having an extra pick and roll creator who can shoot a little bit and is at least at this stage a smart team defender, even if, you know, I do think other teams would, you know, test Nick Nurse's patience and kind of go at Flynn to see what's there. I'm surprised he hasn't gotten a shot yet. Are you surprised? Especially, like, I know Nick Nurse always talks about, you know, how it takes rookies a long time, and I completely understand that just in basketball in general, we should have modest expectations for rookies. But he did, you know, he did lean on Terrence Davis last year and trust him a bunch. And I thought Flynn made a good case through the preseason and allegedly through, like, their offseason workouts and stuff. Are you surprised we haven't seen him?
Yeah, I think, like, my comments would be sort of similar to what I just said about Terrence Davis, minus the, you know, not good stuff.
pretty big minus there.
Yeah, no, for sure. And the only thing I can say is, like, they're already playing small, and, like, maybe he's just not comfortable going smaller. But again, like you said, there's not much of a reason, especially without Derek White, somebody, like, really physical, a physical guard, to not try that against the Spurs a little more. And yeah, it's pretty clear they, of course, that was the Raptors' best offensive game, at least by points. So I'm guessing by offensive rating, although I don't have the numbers in front of me. I'm mildly surprised. Like, when I think about the game flow, I'm not, like, it never seemed like, oh, this is the time for Malachi Flynn, but it also didn't seem like, oh, this is the time for Stanley Johnson, and then he played 22 minutes. So so I think we're getting there is my answer. I haven't been in the moment surprised that we haven't gotten there, if that makes sense. But as Nurse continues to search, I would think sooner rather than later we're going to see him.
Yeah. And again, it's not the biggest thing. I think obviously the highest leverage thing right now is Siakam figuring it out. And again, he's defended well enough and he's improved as a playmaker, but the turnovers and the scoring efficiency, just, he carries too big a load for that not to be the biggest talking point and the biggest swing factor. But you can help him out with some better transitional units, and you can help the whole team out by just not bleeding so badly when Lowry's off the floor. Eric, I don't want this to be 50 minutes of negativity. So we mentioned how good Lowry has been, and I think there's been a little bit of Ananobi positivity, at least in that last game,
for sure.
In terms of, you know, what does his role look like if he's going to bump to 17-18% usage instead of 14-15%, I think that was a good example after he didn't do as good a job making himself available and kind of carrying a threat the first two games.
I think the broadcast has been on it too. Like, they talked about how, like, and we've talked about it too, like, OG plays off whatever is given to him. Like, he's not the top option, so he's not going to, like, hunt the ball. But there's a difference between, you know, waiting for the ball to come to you and waiting for the ball to come to you, but then being ready to do a few different things with it. And I think that's what we saw against Philly. We saw, like, a few more drives and certainly him taking it, like, with more than, like, 5 on the clock. Maybe there was 10 or 12 on the clock, and he went instead of just making the next swing pass. And, you know, it doesn't mean you have to be Chris Boucher out there, you know, popping it every time you get it, although we love Chris Boucher for it. But there is a happy medium, and I mean, OG Anunoby seems like the type of guy who could really learn to like a happy medium. He seems like I think he could find that cool. So we yeah,
would definitely find it cool, or at worst, all right.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, we saw him he's not making the opportunities for himself, but he's taking more of an assertive approach when he got the opportunities, I guess, against Philadelphia, which was encouraging.
Yes. Not encouraging is that he's still only at 13% usage for the season so far, which somehow is even lower.
How many shots did he get in the first game, or was it the Spurs game? One of the games, I think it was the Pelicans game. He has taken
10, 6, and 11 shots.
Oh, okay. It's a Spurs game, I guess. Anywho.
But he plays a lot of minutes, right? So, yeah. And he doesn't really get to the free throw line much. So that's what he's used 30 possessions.
More than Pascal against Philly.
Turnovers. Pardon me?
Got to the line more than Pascal against Philly.
Yeah, twice. also had 5 steals. It was including one of his pick sixes, which are always fun.
I don't think we could just say he's been good. But there, after 2 discouraging games, I'd say that was more along the line. So, I mean, in terms of raw numbers, that's more than you're going to get most nights from him. But in terms of play type, that's more along the lines of what we expect from him, or what the Raptors need to expect from him.
Unless you have another positive that you want to talk about, I think because we haven't done a podcast since the opener, the other positive in general, as you said, would be Chris Boucher's first 2 games. And he didn't play much against Philly because of the Embiid-Howard combination and just them having so much size in general, which, you know, you could question, although I thought other than some turnovers, not being able to catch the ball, Len was mostly fine. Baines obviously had a rough shooting night. But are there any other positives you want to talk about just to end this on a friendlier note? Or is Boucher if we're going Lowry being awesome, OG's 3rd game, is Boucher your 3rd positive so far? Or
I mean, probably. The one thing I'd say, and it will sound like a negative, is Lowry is certainly forcing some pick and roll passes.
Yeah, but they're fun.
Yeah, they're fun, but also... it indicates stuff that will work more as the season goes on, I think. Like, once that chemistry is established. Like, I think...
It does have to be a bit of an adjustment, even for someone who raises the play of others as well as Kyle Lowry, to go from Ibaka, who you'd played with for 3.5 years, and Gasol, who has these magnetic mitts. Like, he's coming from 2 bigs who catch everything to some guys who maybe aren't used to those kind of passes.
Yeah, and
that's what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think like that's on Kyle as much as it's on Baines or Len. Like, he's got to it's teamwork. Like, you've got to know what the other guy's good at, and he's dropping some bounce passes like sort of to the backhand because that's where his guy could theoretically catch it and where the opponent won't be able to, but it's not Marc Gasol who's gonna, you know, again, use his mitt as a his hand as a magnet and then like toss out a pass to an open quarter 3-pointer for an open quarter 3-pointer. It's and like Aaron Baines isn't gonna finish like Serge Ibaka and doesn't have sort of the up and under or the fake baby hook before going glass or something. So but I think like the setups look good. Baines is like an awesome screener. Like he's really set a few bangers out there. So I think they'll get on the same page there eventually, and that will lead to some more offense. I know that's a backdoor way of saying something's a positive, but I can see it if I squint hard enough. Have I convinced you?
No. All right. So I guess the one...
Boucher has definitely like been good. There's rebounding problems with him out there, and those aren't a coincidence. And you can say the team just has to help more, but and that's true. But the guy down low is the guy who has to make the initial at least box out or at least help with the positioning. And if he's being out positioned because he's going for a block shot, it's one thing to say we've got to help out, but That also ends up in situations like all five guys are in the paint and then Seth Curry's shooting a wide open three-pointer, which wasn't a Boucher situation, but, you know, that's...
No, that was a Fred mistake.
Yeah, yeah. But when you're so concerned with what's going on in the paint, that sort of stuff can happen. And as Nick Nurse mentioned, they've let some shooters get going in the first few games. But on the whole... Boucher's been good. Offensively, he's really given it to them. And I think he's their sort of most fun option at center. He's maybe their highest upside individual stats center. So if they can figure out a functional way to play with him, that would be good.
Well, in terms of the Raptors letting shooters get open, things... Hey, a week ago, you might have thought things were about to turn positive. Well, instead, on New Year's Eve, their annual New Year's Eve game against a bad Eastern Conference opponent sees them taking on the league's top three-point shooting team so far, the New York Knicks, 45.9% from outside. Now, they're second last in volume, but they sure can't shoot it. Reggie Bullock, Alec Burks, Julius Randle, Elfrid Payton, Kevin Knox, Frank Ntilikina, all shooting the lights out so far. Color me skeptical. A couple Frank. Of those names keep shooting well. Obi Toppin won't play. I think we don't have an update on Alec Burks yet for that one. But the Knicks are dealing with some injuries, including Obi Toppin, who is a fun rookie and went 3 of 7 on threes in his debut. The Knicks... on paper, aren't very good. They have won their last two games. They blew out the Bucks, and then they beat the Cavs. So
they blew out the Bucks, who then went on to hit NBA record 29, was it, or 28? Three-pointers.
I saw the record. The record-setting three was 28. I don't know what they finished at. They finished at 29. 29 of 51.
NBA's great.
Yeah.
Anyway,
the Knicks should normally... you know, cure what ails you, but they've been the number 12 defense so far. They don't, you know, other than being pretty turnover prone, which maybe can get the Raptors transition game going. The Knicks don't have any like standout weaknesses so far. They're just not super talented, but they've got some guys. And we probably remember from the last couple years that they're also, you know, this is a young team that is probably not going to let you just like foot off the gas in the ways that the Raptors kind of had when they got double digit leads. You know, Mitchell Robinson's a lot of fun. RJ is, I don't know, not figuring it out, but maybe he'll figure it out. That 46% true shooting is not great, but we, as a Canadian podcast, we have to leave room for the possibility that RJ figures it out. And he's also only 20 years old, so that's entirely plausible.
And, like, not playing around the, you know, the ideal supporting cast for maximum growth.
Boy, would Fred VanVleet look good next to him.
No, they had to... What did they do? Did they take on any bad contracts and get picks?
Did they do? I don't think so.
They just signed some guys?
Yeah, I mean, Alec Burks.
Great. Great next. I mean, that's probably better than spending on the wrong guys, but
yeah, I mean, Julius Randle picked up his option for $19 million, so that's what ate some of their space. But like, they've got Noah's dead money on the books.
that's awesome.
Yeah, I don't know. They don't have really like Julius Randle is the only guy on their roster that makes eight figures.
They're just doing a lot of
mid salary guys
doing the whole rebuilding thing. Keep getting those picks.
Sure. And anyway. Oh, that was their big offseason move. They picked up the draft rights to Sergio Llull, one of NBA Twitter's longtime favorite. He is to the rest of NBA Twitter what Nando DiColo is to me, of just, hey, maybe he'll come over this year.
Is his name spelled
even as he's into his mid 30s now?
Is his name spelled with four L's?
Yes, LLULL.
What an impossible name.
Yeah.
That's great.
Anyway, so the Knicks are up next. Then they get a rematch with the Pelicans. And then, boy, if the start to the season hadn't given Raptors fans enough anxiety, the Celtics are on the docket for January 4th. We will be back to talk to you after that one. I don't think we'll squeeze one in on the weekend between New Orleans and Boston. I don't know. I've always felt that three games is a good cadence for the podcast anyway, and it just lines up a little better with the Celtics games and stuff like that. Eric, in prior years, we have forced you to make a prediction on the games ahead in the week, even though we did it inconsistently and don't ever really hold you to it or anything. But Knicks, Pelicans, Celtics, what's going down?
I'm calling a 3-0 week, Blake.
Whew. Wow. 3-0 for the Toronto Raptors, you mean?
No, their opposition. I'm calling 3-0 for the Raptors. I think they're going to get their stuff together, and that might be a bit optimistic. I mean, it's certainly a bit optimistic. It's more of a gut feel thing than any actual analysis, but I think they're going to figure a few things out. I, Boston's play hasn't been overwhelming to start the season, certainly. As the Aaron Baines fan club said, got to get up double digits to blow double digit leads.
Yep. Yep. That's a matter of fact. That is how it has to go down. You can. So that'll be three games before we podcast again. Of course, you can check out all our written analysis at theathletic.com. If you're not a subscriber yet, theathletic.com/we the six for buy one, gift one deal between now and January 3rd, or click on one of Minor Eric's articles for a flash sale up until the stroke of midnight. I don't know if that's programmed to disappear at the stroke of midnight, but, you know, it, also if at the stroke of midnight, that's what you're doing, I'm sorry. I don't even want to spend New Year's with me. But here we are in quarantine for New Year's. Eric, thank you so much, man. Any parting shots before we let you go?
Just a sincere thank you to the listeners and the readers over at The Athletic for supporting us in this year, the weirdest and in many ways worst of years. Let's sort of try to be better in 2021 and not rely on a random number changing for things to get better. We got to do some of that heavy lifting ourselves.
Arbitrary endpoints, baby.
Yeah, I'm speaking more broadly than, are we calling the, I guess when it starts is pretty random. Which makes the ending pretty random. Let's put in some good work in order to make this this rock a better place. But also, sincerely, thank you for supporting us. I know there were some tough, slow months in there, and we appreciate it as well. So thank you.
Yeah, I will echo that. Thank you, Eric. And thanks to producer Andrew, who I don't know if I'm supposed to shout out or not, but we appreciate him as well. Eric, thanks, man. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Blake. See ya.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.